Okay, let's unpack this. We're diving deep today into the second commandment. You shall not make for yourselves any graven images.
Right.
Now, you might hear that and think, okay, simple enough. Maybe sounds a bit historical, dry even.
Yeah, like something out of a textbook.
But the sources you've shared, they reveal this ancient command has actually sparked, well, a surprising amount of controversy throughout religious history. And it still impacts interpretations today.
Absolutely. And the very first layer of complexity our sources dig into is right there at the beginning. Is this even its own commandment, number two?
Well, or is it just a part B?
Exactly. Yeah. Or is it just like 1B, a continuation of the first commandment, you shall have no other gods before me? Different traditions, they really land in different places on this basic question.
Right. So you've got traditions like Judaism, most Protestants, Eastern Orthodoxy. They generally treat it as its own thing, number two.
Mm-hmm.
And often that leads them to read it pretty broadly, suggesting it maybe prohibits all images, not just, you know, idols of other gods.
But then, like the sources show, you have other groups, Catholics, Lutherans are the examples given, who more often see it folded into the first commandment.
Okay.
And that tends to narrow the focus, right? So the idea becomes it's primarily against images of pagan gods, specifically. Not necessarily images of the Lord or maybe saints that are used within worship.
And that difference wasn't just academic, was it?
Oh, not at all. That distinction, it fueled massive historical conflicts. Famously, the iconoclasm controversy in the Eastern Orthodox Church. We're talking centuries of debate, sometimes violent, over religious images.
It's just fascinating how much hangs on that initial numbering and interpretation.
It really is.
And the sources point out the wording itself kind of leaves the door open. It says, don't make an image in the form of anything in heaven above or on earth beneath or in the waters below.
Mm-hmm. Very broad.
Very broad. It doesn't explicitly say an image of God, although that next bit about bowing down and worshiping them, that seems to point towards idols, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And worship.
It does. And that's the tension, right? You've got the broad description, anything.
Right.
But then the context seems focused on worship, bowing down.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly where the different interpretations come from.
So is it about banning all art that depicts something? Or is it specifically about images used for, you know, religious devotion, for idolatry?
That's the core question.
Okay. So our mission here with this deep dive is to sift through these sources you've brought together. We want to unpack the layers, the meaning, the history, the surprising implications of this commandment.
Yeah. Why has it been such a flashpoint?
Exactly. Why does it matter beyond just, you know, don't have statues in your house?
All right. Let's dive in.
Okay. So, first things first, what did idol even mean back then in the context of this commandment? Because like you said, we use that word pretty loosely today.
Yeah, that's a really key starting point from the sources. Yeah.
Yeah.
We need to forget our modern idea of an idol being like a pop star or something.
Right.
In the ancient Middle East, an idol was specifically an image, a physical representation of a god. It was an object made to embody or connect with divine power.
And these weren't always like little action figures of gods, right?
Huh. No, not at all. The sources describe a huge variety. You had anthropomorphic figures, so human-shaped ones, representing gods like Baal.
Okay.
There were theriomorphic or animal forms, think Egyptian gods, lots of those. Mm. You'd see symbols, too, like the sun disk for Aten or different star symbols.
Mm.
And even things we might not immediately think of as idols, like standing stones or pillars, massabots, they're called. Or even specific trees or groves set aside as sacred representations.
Wow. So basically anything could be used to represent a deity.
Pretty much. And here's where it gets particularly interesting, belief-wise. Ancient peoples often believed the god's spirit or presence wasn't just represented by the image, but could actually inhabit it, or at least be fundamentally tied to it. The idol wasn't just a picture of the god. For them, in a very real sense, it was the god made present.
Wow. So a genuine belief that the divine was like physically in the object.
Yes. And the sources talk about these elaborate rituals designed specifically to make that connection happen. Ceremonies like the cleansing of the mouth and the opening of the mouth.
Mm.
These weren't just symbolic acts. They were believed to actually animate the image, to forge a literal link between the, you know, the distant deity and this physical thing on earth.
So a piece of wood or stone goes from just being stuff to being sacred, potentially holding the god's presence because of these rituals.
Exactly. That transformation from just an object to a sacred idol believed to be, well, imbued with the god's presence that was absolutely central to their religious practice.
Okay, so given how widespread this was, the sources make it clear, like, everyone in the ancient world had their gods and their images.
It was the norm, absolutely.
Then Israel's position must have been incredibly countercultural, like really strange to their neighbors?
Utterly unique. You have this ancient landscape just filled with temples, statues, symbols of deities everywhere. And then there's Israel, deliberately having no images of their god.
Yeah.
Our sources mention this amazing anecdote. When the Greeks first really encountered the Jews during the Hellenistic period, they were just astonished.
Why?
Because the Jews had no visible idols. The Greeks actually called them a nation of atheists.
A nation of atheists, just because they couldn't see their god in a statue?
Wow. It really puts into perspective how radical Israel's stance was, doesn't it?
It really does. But the sources also show, look, this wasn't easy for them. There was a constant struggle with this commandment, right?
Well, there really was. And what's striking, maybe even a bit ironic, is that this command was given right around the time the Israelites were already demanding an idol.
You mean the golden calf?
Exactly. God had given them these tangible, visible signs of his presence, the pillar of cloud, the pillar of fire.
Right. Very visible.
Very visible. But when Moses was up on the mountain, delayed, the people got antsy, impatient. They go to Aaron and basically say, look, we want a visible God we can see, maybe one we can control, something that can lead us back to Egypt.
Back to Egypt. They wanted something tangible, something predictable, maybe something they can manipulate instead of this invisible sovereign God who just rescued them.
Precisely. Oh. And the sources show this tension, this ideological struggle. It didn't just disappear after Sinai. It runs right through Israelite history. Mm-hmm. So while the prophets are constantly condemning the outright worship of foreign gods, you know, Baal, Asherah, mm-hmm. with their images, mm-hmm. there were also these critiques suggesting maybe attempts to use images potentially meant to represent the Lord himself, yeah. highlighting that the problem wasn't always just adopting foreign gods, but sometimes misunderstanding or, well, misrepresenting their own God in forbidden ways.
And we see evidence of this struggle not just in the Bible, but in the ground too, right? Archaeology. Oh. Our sources mention findings that kind of challenge the idea of a perfectly idol-free Israel.
We do, yeah. Excavations, even in Jerusalem and other Judean cities, have turned up numerous idols from certain periods.
Like what kind of things?
Well, we found figures of Sekhmet. She's an Egyptian goddess of healing and war. Images of Bez. He's that Egyptian dwarf god, popular for protecting households, especially women in childbirth. The Eye of Horus, another protective symbol. Various fertility figurines. Scarabs, those beetle amulets representing rebirth. Stuff like that.
So definitely foreign idols kicking around.
Absolutely. Often linked, the sources suggest, to things like political alliances or cultural exchange, especially with Egypt, which, by the way, the prophets were always warning against.
Right. But what's even more complex, maybe, are findings like that Hezekiah seal you mentioned from the 8th century BC, a time we usually think of as having religious reform.
Exactly. This seal, which might have belonged to King Hezekiah himself, it shows the Egyptian Ankh symbol, the symbol for life, right next to a winged sun disk.
Which was a common symbol.
All over the ancient Near East, really. Often associated with deities or royalty. And the sources raise this really interesting question. Could that winged sun disk on a seal potentially belonging to a reforming king have been intended by some people, at least, to represent the Lord?
Ah, thereby potentially violating the second commandment, even during a supposedly faithful period.
It's a possibility that's raised. It's fascinating because it suggests the issue wasn't always black and white, not just obvious pagan statues, but maybe symbols or images whose meaning was ambiguous or perhaps even co-opted in a forbidden way.
It points to, like you said, a persistent problem, both with clear pagan stuff and maybe these more ambiguous, potentially forbidden depictions related to the Lord. That just kept cropping up until the Second Temple period.
Right. That seems to be the picture.
Which brings us to a really significant shift, according to the sources. What changed in Judaism after the temple was rebuilt, around 515 BC, in that Second Temple period?
Yeah. This era saw a pretty dramatic change. Mm-hmm. Actual pagan idolatry seems to become far less common among Jews. That problem really recedes.
Okay.
But interestingly, there was a marked increase in strictness regarding any kind of representational art, even stuff that wasn't religious.
So the focus kind of broadened beyond just idols for worship.
Seems so. The sources describe incidents like violent reactions, even riots, when the Romans tried to bring images into Jerusalem, like their military standards,
yeah.
which had eagles or other animal depictions on them.
Right.
And Herod the Great, when he rebuilt the temple, he was apparently meticulous about not offending Jewish sensibilities on this, he specifically excluded all representational art. No animals, no humans, definitely no gods, but not even other figures.
So the interpretation seemed to swing much harder towards prohibiting images of, well, living things generally.
That was certainly a strong trend, although the sources are careful to note it wasn't maybe absolute or constant. There were periods where this strictness seemed to relax a bit. They mention examples like 4th century synagogue mosaics that actually included things like the zodiac with its figures.
Mm-hmm.
But the dominant approach, especially around the temple and Jerusalem, was very cautious, avoiding images even in what we might consider secular contests.
And this is where the sources ask that interesting question. Was this maybe a pedantic misunderstanding?
Potentially, yeah.
Taking a commandment that seems focused on idols for worship and applying it much more broadly to all images, including just decorative art.
It's a reasonable question, especially when you look at the original commandment's context, which really links making images to bowing down and worshiping them.
Right.
So the sources highlight this possibility. Maybe this later, broader interpretation extended the prohibition beyond what was originally intended.
It just shows how interpretations can evolve, can't they?
Definitely.
Now, shifting gears a bit, how did this commandment, this whole issue of images, play out in the early Christian church?
Well, the sources point out first that Jesus himself didn't really teach specifically on this commandment, not in the way he addressed others, like murder or adultery. And when you look at figures like Paul or John in the New Testament, when they talk about idols, they really seem to be talking about pagan idols, the ones worshipped by non-Jews, by Gentiles.
So initially, it wasn't a major internal debate for Christians. Like, they weren't arguing about statues of Jesus right away.
Not in the same way as the conflict of pagan gods, no. But the question of images within Christian practice, that did arise just more gradually. The use of iconography, so religious images or icons used for devotion, started to appear more widely around the 3rd century AD.
And this, just like in Judaism's history, eventually led to major conflict.
It certainly did, primarily in the Eastern Orthodox Church. It led to the famous or infamous iconoclasm controversy, sometimes called the Icon Wars.
Wow, icon war.
Yeah, it involved periods where religious images were actively destroyed, their use forbidden, followed by periods where they were reinstated, went back and forth. And interestingly, the sources mention a theory that this strong movement against images in the East might have been influenced, at least in part, by the strict rejection of representational art in early Islam, which was rising at the time.
Ah, okay. So the arguments against using icons were pretty powerful at the time.
They were. And even though the Orthodox Church ultimately affirmed the use of icons, rejecting iconoclasm.
Right.
The arguments developed by the iconoclasts, the ones who opposed images, they definitely resonated later on.
Wow.
They significantly influenced thinkers during the Protestant Reformation.
Which explains why many Protestant traditions today still have a strong reservation or even an outright rejection of images within worship settings. They're drawing on those historical arguments.
Exactly. That history has a long shadow.
Okay, so we've traced the history, the controversies, the different interpretations, but let's get to the core theological question the sources raise. Why? Why were images, specifically images of the Lord, prohibited in the first place? It's not just an arbitrary rule, is it?
No, definitely not.
Especially since, as the sources note, the Bible itself uses so many metaphors and images for God in language: shepherd, king, rock, father.
That's the crucial distinction, isn't it?
Yeah.
Literary imagery versus physical graven images. And yes, the sources help us explore the deeper theological principles behind prohibiting the graven images.
Okay. What's the first big principle?
Limitation of God. That's a key one. Basically, no physical image, nothing we can make, can adequately capture or contain the sheer fullness of God's transcendence.
Mm-hmm.
Remember when Solomon dedicates the temple, even this magnificent structure, he says, you know, even the highest heaven cannot contain you, how much less this house I have built.
Right. God's too big.
Way too big. Isaiah asks rhetorically, where is the house you will build for me? And where will my resting place be? The implication is nowhere on earth.
So God is just too vast, too infinite to be confined to any physical thing we make.
Exactly. And the danger with a physical image is that it inevitably reduces God. It limits our understanding of who God is and maybe where God can be found.
Yep.
When that image gets kind of fixed in our minds, set in stone, so to speak, it can really shrink our vision of the divine. The sources give that poignant example of a child.
Oh, yeah.
Who saw a picture of Jesus, maybe in Sunday school, and later couldn't believe something else was God because God has long hair. referring back to that specific picture.
Ah, right. The image becomes the definition, the limit.
Precisely. That's the inherent danger. It limits our concept of the infinite.
That really resonates. Okay, so principle one, avoiding limiting God. What's the second principle the sources highlight?
Manipulation of God. This is another big one. Idols, unlike the true living God, could be, well, controlled or manipulated by humans.
How so?
Well, the sources describe how in some ancient rituals, priests might feed the idol by pouring out libations or leaving food. And since the statue obviously didn't refuse it, that was interpreted as the god accepting the offering. You could paint the idol to look happy or fierce, depending on what you wanted. You could carry it to battle and expect it to fight for you on your terms.
Right. Unlike the real God, who acts according to his own will, not ours.
Yeah.
You can't just, you know, paint a smile on God.
Exactly. And the golden calf incident, going back to that, it can really be understood in this light, too. By creating their own God, the people were seeking a deity they could essentially direct. Give us a God who will lead us where we want to go.
Mm-hmm.
It was an attempt to have a controllable God, one that would serve their agenda, maybe even lead them back to the familiar comforts of Egypt, rather than submitting to the unpredictable, sometimes uncomfortable leading of the God who had actually freed them.
Limitation and manipulation. Those are really powerful reasons. Okay, what's the third principle the sources bring out?
This one's maybe a bit more subtle, but just as important. Idols tend to embody human biases and values, rather than reflecting God's values.
Ah, explain that a bit more.
Well, if you look at ancient idols, or even a lot of historical religious art, they often reflect what humans consider ideal. Ideals of beauty, power, what's important to us. The sources note, for instance, how Greek gods are almost always depicted as, you know, physically perfect by human standards. Not overweight, not bald, always beautiful.
So we end up making God in our image.
Yes.
Instead of trying to understand ourselves as made in his image.
That's exactly the danger. And the sources bring this right up to the present day. Think about attempts to depict Jesus or even God the Father. Those images inevitably reflect human idealizations, sometimes even racial biases.
Yeah.
The source asks that provocative question, is God white or black? You have to choose.
Right.
Because a physical image forces God into human categories, human limitations.
Right.
So instead of letting God's reality challenge our biases and shape our values, we project our values, our preferences, our biases onto the divine image we create. Idols end up embodying what we want God to be, but God actually wants us to be formed into his likeness.
Wow. That brings it into such sharp focus. It really isn't just about banning art. It's about protecting the very nature of the relationship with God from being distorted by our own limits, our desire for control, and our inherent biases.
Exactly right. And all of this leads beautifully into what the sources identify as the one image of God that the Bible not only permits, but actually cherishes and endorses.
Okay. The true image.
Yes. And it is humanity itself.
People.
People.
Cool.
Genesis says God made humanity in his image. Now, the full meaning of that is incredibly profound and debated. But at its core, it means that God is uniquely represented, uniquely manifest to the world through human beings.
And the ultimate expression of this is Jesus.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely. Jesus himself said, if you have seen me, you have seen the Father. The sources really emphasize this. It's in Jesus' full humanity, his life, his compassion, his teaching, his actions as a human being, that the fullness of God is most perfectly revealed to us.
Mm-hmm.
You don't see God by somehow separating Jesus' divinity from his human form. You see the divine within and through that perfect humanity.
So humanity, people, in our very essence, are the image of God that we're meant to focus on and interact with.
That's the powerful connection the sources draw. The most profound devotion, the truest worship, isn't really directed towards a physical object, no matter how sacred we might try to make it.
Okay.
It's found in how we interact with the true image of God, already present in the world.
Uh-huh.
Other people. Serving our neighbors, caring for the poor, clothing the naked, feeding the hungry. The sources suggest these actions embody the real spirit of worship.
Because we're ministering to God's actual image.
Exactly. We are serving the actual cherished image of God that is present in the people all around us, whether they're wealthy or poor, powerful or vulnerable, like us or different from us.
Wow. This deep dive has really been quite a journey. We've gone from, you know, ancient controversies about statues,
yeah,
all the way to these profound theological principles behind what seems like a simple commandment, and culminating in this really powerful idea of humanity itself as God's designated image.
We've seen that the prohibition of graven images, especially images of the Lord, goes so much deeper than just forbidding physical art. It's fundamentally about safeguarding the nature of God, protecting it from being reduced controlled or misshapen by our own human limitations and biases.
And recognizing that even though the Bible uses incredibly rich language, metaphors, literary images for God, it specifically forbids graven images because they pose that unique danger of replacing the infinite, sovereign, living reality of God with a limited, controllable, human-made construct.
Well said. The real challenge isn't just about avoiding statues. It's about recognizing where God's presence is truly, uniquely, and intentionally manifest in the world around us.
So maybe here's a final thought to leave you, the listener, with after exploring this command. In our modern world, which might feel pretty free from literal ancient idols, how might we still be tempted? Tempted to create limited, comfortable concepts of God that just happen to fit our own preferences? How might we subtly, maybe unknowingly, try to manipulate divine will through actions or our prayers or even our beliefs? And how often are we projecting our own biases, our own values, maybe even our prejudices onto our understanding of God?
It's a constant check we need.
Yeah. Perhaps the most challenging and the most relevant call of this ancient commandment for us today is that imperative to truly see and to truly honor the image of God, not in some static, perfect depiction we might wish for, but in the dynamic, complex, sometimes messy, and often uncomfortable reality of the human beings we encounter every single day.